Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Bitcoin Way podcast. I'm your host, Michael Jordan, and I appreciate you being here. I wrapped up a fantastic conversation this morning with Jordan Bush, executive director at Thank God for Bitcoin, also a co-author of the book with the same name. Jordan's a really cool guy, really interesting conversation. Full disclosure, as a Christian, there were a lot of just personal curiosities that I had and wanted to engage with him on. But I think even if you're just thinking about the ethics of money printing and what Bitcoin could mean for the world, this is a fantastic conversation and episode to listen into. I hope you enjoy the conversation as much as I did. Alrighty, like I said in the intro, I've got Jordan here. Jordan, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael, thanks for having me, man.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. This is a conversation I'm looking forward to as a Christ follower myself, and I imagine you've got a lot of insights. You think about all of the topics we're going to cover today a lot, I suspect. So sure. Before we jump into Bitcoin specifically, I'm curious your journey to faith and then your journey into Bitcoin and which one preceded the other.
Yeah. First of all, thanks for having me. Appreciate, again, the opportunity to talk about these things. Yeah, my name is Jordan Bush. I grew up in a Christian family. I was a second-generation Christian on my mom's side second-generation Christian on my dad's side and a third-generation Christian on my mom's side. So my dad, came to know the Lord as a young kid. His dad was an alcoholic, took him to the bar as a little kid, and so then he came to faith in high school through the efforts and love and intentionality of this small Baptist church. And so we my life looks completely differently because of those people. So I'm very grateful to them. And so then for my entire life, my parents have worked for this Christian nonprofit organization called Word of Life. And so I grew up there, grew up going to church, every Sunday. And so made, a profession of faith at a very young age and, really did, love the Lord and saw my need for a savior and just enjoyed, reading the word and memorizing it. We had like Awana clubs and so I would memorize scripture and, really enjoyed doing that. And then got into middle school, started going to public school and I was just really a people pleaser and just was like I just wanted friends. And so was willing to kind of compromise. There was really no Christians around me. And so just was willing to compromise to try to be accepted and just be seen as normal. And so then that kind of led, away from the Lord. And it was while I was in high school, I went to this Christian camp. I had no desire for God and, went there to play basketball and meet girls. And it was during that time that in God's providence, one of my dad's best friends preached the gospel. And he'd been like another father figure to me. He preached the gospel. I could have articulated to you every single thing that he said that day. And yet when he preached that message, it was just like the scales fall from the eyes. And I conceptually knew everything that he said could have articulated to you. But just the reality of like Jesus loves me. Mm-hmm. That was the thing that kind of just, broke through and it came with power. And the evidence of that was, I remember distinctly being 14 years old and my dad was trying to get me to read the Bible. And I just remember holding up the Bible. I said, this book is stupid. Why would I waste my time with this stupid book and like toss it down, went to my room and was just, angry. And flash forward a couple years, hear the gospel preached and all I wanted to do was to pray and read the Bible. And I just would have told you, if you'd have told me, hey, you're going to want to read the Bible and pray, I would have told you, you were a moron. And so that kind of started a different trajectory, still imperfect, had all kinds of, just bumps along the road, but there was definitely a trajectory change of desire to want to know the Lord. And so then over time that, led me to, I went to Bible college, ended up, met my future wife there. We got married. We went as church planters to Uruguay. And this is kind of where some of the Bitcoin journey comes in as well. So moved to Uruguay. Uruguay is this very secular place. We went there thinking that we were going to plant a church in one of the most secular parts of the city. You're talking a neighborhood of around 500,000 people. And we were thinking we were going to move there and plant a church and among these very atheistic, agnostic people. We get there and quickly find that our church becomes composed of mostly, or at least half, and it was more in the beginning, but Venezuelan immigrants. And so these were people who had their currency hyperinflated and you know, vaporized, became worthless overnight. Not so much overnight, but over the course of you know, a few months and years. And so again, we just saw, I didn't know anything about the history of monetary devaluation. I didn't know much about, you know, immigration or, you know, any, I hadn't studied any of that thing. I'd studied the Bible. And so as we're trying to help these people pick up the pieces of their lives and, you know, and broadly what it was fathers who had left Venezuela. They left their wives and kids to try to move, get a job, send money home, and then eventually save up enough to bring their families with them. On paper, that looked, you know, that seemed pretty plausible and pretty doable, but just the reality of, you know, of just being a person who just recently moved to a country is that things are way harder than you think they're going to be. And so it just took way more time than they were anticipating. Things were not as good economically as they were thinking, or not as you know, approachable and easy for them to just start over. And so we saw infidelity that resulted from that. We saw, you know, just the reality of fathers spending years away from their kids. It just was awful. And so it was through that process that I really just started to try to understand why that was happening, and, you know, how, like, to see, like, is there anything we can do about this? So on the ground, we're sitting there helping them, you know, we're helping them, you know, buy furniture and, you know, doing some counseling and, you know, just trying to serve them as best we can, you know, in every way possible. But at the same time, me, you know, I was a philosophy major in college, so I'm trying to think through, like, what are the bigger picture issues here? And, you know, I was trying to understand them and figure out, is there something that we can do to help with this? And so, the more that I, you know, researched and again, this is all kind of passively being done. It wasn't like, I'm going to sit down and figure all this out. Just over the course of a few years, just kind of got my hands around the fact that almost every currency, if not all, every currency in Latin America has failed 3 to 4 times, since 1971, when the U.S. went off the gold standard, and then just seeing what that does to normal people and institutions like churches. So there's been missionary work that's been done. It was done in the 50s that should have borne a lot more fruit than it has. But every 14, 15 years on average, you have the currency fail. So imagine you're a church planter. Imagine you're a missionary. You go there, you start a church, and you know, you're small in the beginning. You can't afford to buy a building. So you go and, you know, you start saving up your people. You know, you're casting vision. Your people are buying in, your people are saying, hey, we want to build a building. So they're denying themselves. They could be buying things for themselves. They could be buying things for, you know, other people. They could be doing all kinds of stuff with that money in the immediate term, but they say, no, we're going to deny ourselves and we're going to save up this money to be able to buy a building that will benefit the church for a long time. In the meantime, your currency fails. Every 13, 14 years, your currency fails and that money becomes worthless. And so it's just this massive, it has been, it's this massive thing that just crushes normal people, small businesses, nonprofit organizations, churches. Like, they just get constantly just kicked in the teeth, you know, every 14, 15 years. And it just basically brings you back to zero. So if you're not storing money in something that is scarce and can't be devalued the way that the actual money itself can, then you're going to be starting over. So understanding that, you know, really affected me. And I just saw, like, man, this is a hamster wheel to nowhere. Like, we're just sitting here, you know, everybody's dealing with this. And so just was thinking, like, is there some sort of, you know, some sort of alternative to this? Like, what do you even do about this? So then around that time that I heard about Bitcoin, and just started to try to understand Bitcoin and found that Bitcoin was literally created to solve that exact problem, you know, of being a money that couldn't be devalued by governments or central banks or any of these things. And so again, my initial, you know, I bought a little bit of Bitcoin cause I was like, hey, I need to find something to invest in. Everything else is at all time highs. I'll buy some of this Bitcoin. But didn't know anything. So I bought a little bit and then, you know, forgot about it when the price went down in 2017 or 2018. And then it was a couple of years later that I just was like, all right, I need to understand this thing. Went down the rabbit hole and really just started to see, wow, wait, this is really interesting in a bunch of different ways. And then on top of that, again, just a lot of the, what was really more interesting to me than Bitcoin itself was what Bitcoin is built on. We're just trying to figure out what are the philosophical, what are the ideas undergirding Bitcoin. And I just started to see a lot of overlap between the priorities in the way that Bitcoin is structured and the way that God tells us to prioritize and tells us to do things. There's a structure to that. And so the more that I saw overlap there, the more curious I was, and the more I wanted to talk about those things. I wanted to talk about them with other people, kind of, you know, and do this in community. And so I ended up, long story short, getting put in a Telegram chat with a group of like 10 other Christians who were into Bitcoin. And that ended up over the course of a few months turning into a book called Thank God for Bitcoin. And so then since then, I've just been getting more and more into Bitcoin, and I now work in this full time. So this is, I have these conversations for a living.
Yeah. I love that. I've only been working in Bitcoin for a few months now, and it's such a cool thing to that my part of my job is just to talk with people like yourself and explore some of these topics in more detail. So maybe let's talk a little bit about the book and sort of the movement, I guess. Thank God for Bitcoin. Yep. So how did the book come about? There are multiple authors on it. What was sort of the way that you arranged that and went about pulling it all together?
Yeah, honestly, it was the last thing on my mind. I got asked, I tweeted something about Bitcoin and Christianity, and had a guy who basically saw that and said, "Hey man, hey, we're doing this book club. If you're interested, I'd be happy to add you to the group." And so I was like, "That'd be awesome. Yeah, sure." So he put me in this Telegram group, and in this Telegram group were like Jimmy Song, and like, I had no clue who Jimmy was at that point. I just knew he was like, "Okay, this is this Asian guy with a cowboy hat. Like, what's going on with that?" And so then again, there's some other well-known people within the Bitcoin world, and then other entrepreneurs who are less known but incredibly brilliant and talented, and so we ended up in this group. We read through two books. One of them was called The Ethics of Money Production by Jörg Guido Holzmann. They had already been meeting for like a month by the time I joined the group. I was the Apostle Paul of the group, added late, out of season. And so I ended up getting in added late. So I finished the last 2 weeks of The Ethics of Money Production. It's a fantastic book. I can't recommend it enough to like pastors and leaders and stuff and normal people too. But, so read through that one. And again, just talking about the idea that, you know, everybody understands, and Christians have done phenomenal work to talk about the morality involved in what you do with money. But there, at least to my knowledge, has been almost very little work done to explain the idea that there are ethical concerns in the creation of money, in the way that money is created, itself. And so I had never heard that, never thought about that. And so, just Holzmann's book was really influential on me, impacted me a lot. And we finished that one, and then we started reading a book by a Christian philosopher. His name was Gary North. He was actually the economic advisor for Ron Paul during one of his presidential runs. So, again, great guy. He's written, just prolifically. I mean, the guy just has written so much and then given away a lot of it about, the intersection of Christianity and economics. So we read one of his books called Honest Money. It's a very, beginner level, written at probably like a ninth or 10th grade level. So we read through that book designed, he just talks about a lot of the issues. An example of this would be, he talks about how because of inflation, even apart from inflation, this is one way that this same dynamic worked out. He talked about, there was guys who would make wine, winemakers. So one of the things that they could do to try to increase their profits would be to introduce a little bit of water into their wine. They'd water it down a little bit. And so when you do that, let's say you add 10% water to your wine. Now that's 10% more, like your wine goes 10% further, and that's more money that you can make. And so this is dishonest. It's not good. But this is what happens over time. People look for shortcuts to try to increase their margins. Gary North brings out that this happens with money as well, specifically where there's money made out of metals. Let's say the money is gold or silver. If you introduce baser metals, so more worthless metals, or less valuable, less precious metals into the money supply, rather than having a coin that's made out of 99% silver, you make it out of 95% silver or 90% silver. It looks pretty much the same to the naked eye. You can't tell the difference. But the production of those coins is a lot, it's much cheaper. And so that's a way in which sovereigns or governments throughout time have tried to, expand their purchasing power or the power of their currency to be able to fund, whether it's wars, whether it's their own lifestyles or whatever it is. And so he talks a lot about those kind of issues, and it really impacted me. So we finished those books, said goodbye to those guys, thought, well, that was the weirdest thing that I ever did. Christian Bible club with Bitcoiners, or Christian book club with Bitcoiners, weird. And so then 2 weeks later, one of the guys reached out and said, hey, we appreciated your contributions. We're going to write this book called Thank God for Bitcoin. Or we're going to write this book basically summarizing all the things we learned from these two books, but rather than the payoff being gold, which was the case in both Holzman's book and Gary North's book, we're going to write a book that has Bitcoin as the payoff. Like, we think Bitcoin actually is a more reasonable and stronger way to kind of embody these principles that we all agree are really important. We think Bitcoin is a better, does this better than gold would, given where we are in world history. And so I said, hey, I buy into that thesis, but I'm at that point, I was a pastor in Uruguay. I was like, I don't have time to write a book. Like, I just don't have time to do that. And he said, hey, well, here's what we're going to do. We're going to work on it like one day a week for a couple hours. We're going to, schedule a meeting. We'll get together and do this. And then we'll have in the beginning, we'll have like a couple Saturdays where we'll do some more labor intensive stuff. So we'll, 4 hours on a Saturday or something. And I was like, okay, I think I can do that. And so long story short, we ended up doing it, ended up writing the book. The book came out in early, January 2021. It was a really, really neat, interesting process. Learned a lot through that process. And then the book came out. And again, then the book was basically way better received than we could have ever imagined. I mean, I think we've sold something in the neighborhood of like 45,000 copies of Thank God for Bitcoin.
Wow.
So it's not going to be like a New York Times bestseller or anything, but like 45,000 copies. I had no idea that there'd be that much interest. So it was a great thing to be a part of, learned a lot, we've seen a lot of people, more well-known people. We had, I think, Greg Abbott, who's the governor of Texas, I think has like two or three copies of the book. Just different people gave it to him. There have been a number of senators, a number of congressmen, and then just other Christian leaders. I mean, just there's people who, I mean, there's a guy, what is his name? Tom Askell, who's, we're well known in the, Reformed Baptist world. There's a bunch of people who, have read the book or just encountered the ideas of the book and found them helpful. So I think more than anything else, I mean, there's plenty of other people. There's tons of other Christians who are into Bitcoin and are creating their own resources or who are, thinking about these things. And so it's been really cool to see kind of ours was like kind of the first book to market to kind of spur some of these conversations. And kind of provide through the conference a place for, people, interested parties to come together and engage with these ideas and bring other people from their churches or nonprofit organizations to kind of think through some of these issues that, basically nobody's thinking about.
Right. That's all. Congratulations, man. I don't think I realized like the scale of your success selling that book. So that's incredible. What would you frame as like what are one or two of the most significant consequences of a fiat standard? Like, and you can take this through the lens of a Christian or not, but like, what do you view as Bitcoin solving that's like most fundamental to ongoing prosperity or peace or what have you?
Yeah. So again, there's two general spheres in which you can answer that question. Somebody asked Jesus, what is the greatest commandment? Which of the commandments is the most important? And Jesus said, what do you think? And the guy responds, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And then, Jesus says, yeah. And then he said, love your neighbor. And so Jesus elsewhere, somebody asked him that, and he gives those same answers, but he basically said the second one is like it.
Like the first. Yeah.
Yeah. The second one is like the first. And so what he's saying is, he's like, these are, you know, equal importance. You can't do one of these without doing the other. This is why the Pharisees got in trouble, is because the Pharisees tried to justify, they said, we're going to love God so much. Like we care so much about loving God that we don't have time to love our neighbor. Like they had what were called Corbin laws, where they could, you know, rather than, you know, God told them to take care of their parents when their parents got old. And they said, no, we're going to give this money to the temple. You know, we love God too much to just, you know, we love God so much that we're willing to, you know, to not give money to our own parents for the sake of loving God. And Jesus just calls foul on all that. He says, no, you're supposed to both love God and love your neighbor. You don't pit these things against each other. And so if I were to say, what is the biggest thing, the biggest issues with Bitcoin and the biggest problems with fiat currency and the biggest ways in which Bitcoin fixes things, there'd be one answer in each of those two spheres. So the question is, you know, what in the world does fiat currency have to do with loving God? and I would say there's way more than you think. So in the book of Romans, Romans chapter 1, the Apostle Paul, he's laying out, like, what is the root of sin? What is the nature of what sin is? And so Paul says, they refuse to acknowledge God as God or be thankful. This is like the seed form of what sin is. And so again, this is, you can look at this, what's an event where this happens. Well, Genesis chapter 3, Adam and Eve refused to acknowledge God as God or be thankful for the way that he'd made them, the world that he'd put them in. He'd given them everything that they need. They refused to acknowledge God telling them, don't eat the fruit of this tree or you'll surely die. They eat the fruit and they die. they didn't acknowledge his leadership or acknowledge his authority or were they grateful for what they had? They only looked at the thing that they didn't have and they took that. So what are some ways in which, you know, you do that? What does that look like to acknowledge God and to be thankful to him? Well, one of the ways that it looks is to acknowledge the way that God has designed the world to function. And so you acknowledge that God made the world a certain way. And in the way that you acknowledge and the way that you are grateful for that is by submitting yourself to that design for the world. And one of the things that, as I was, again, I was a pastor when I first started looking into Bitcoin, was I was studying one day. I was in the book of Galatians chapter 6. The Apostle Paul says that God is not mocked, for what a man sows, that will he also reap. And so as I was sitting there, I was thinking about this and I was just trying to think, like, what are some examples of this? What are some examples of sowing and reaping? And so you can think of something like, logic itself. If I toss a ball in the air, it's going to have a consequence. Actions have consequences. That's just basically another summary of sowing and reaping. This is structured everywhere. The Apostle Paul says, if someone's not willing to work, then neither should he eat. So he's saying, if you're not willing to work, then the consequence is you don't eat. Now, why those two things? Because the point of eating food is to give you energy to work. And if you're not acknowledging this relationship, the relationship that God has designed to exist between food and work, then you shouldn't eat. And then over a long enough time horizon, what's the consequence of not eating? Yeah, you die.
You die.
And so if you're not willing to do work, then effectively, if you follow the logic, then you should die. Like we are here to work both for the glory of God and the good of our neighbor. So this is one example. Again, there's just a ton more. There's a ton more examples of, you know, if this, then this, sowing and reaping. You know, there's a logic to, let's say, marriage or sex. Sex is this great thing. God has a logic to it. First of all, in order to you know, reap the ability to enjoy the good gift of sex, you get married first. You know, you get married first and then you have sex with, you know, your wife and you enjoy this. God has parameters. And so to acknowledge God is to acknowledge his design for marriage, for sex, for, you know, all these things. God has a design. And one of the ways that we recognize and demonstrate gratefulness to God is by submitting ourselves to his design in the world. And so the thing that impacted me as I was thinking about Bitcoin and fiat currency was the fact that fiat currency is money that is just created out of thin air. There's no production cost. It's money that enables governments and central banks to create money rapidly out of thin air with no work. Now, occasionally I get people who quibble with me. They're like, well, I mean, they still have to print the pieces of paper with the, you know, the ink. So like there actually is a production cost. And it's like, hey, my guy, like you can literally create the same effort in 99.9% of the same effort that goes into creating a $1 bill, you can use to create a $100 bill. The only difference is you're talking a fraction of an amount of ink to put mm-hmm. two zeros on the end of a one rather than that. And so that's a far cry from something like gold or silver where there's a fixed production cost to it. Mm-hmm. If you're going to produce gold or silver coins, you have to pay guys to go out and dig up the raw materials out of the ground to purify them. You have to have them pay for the tools to be able to do that. Then you have to bring it back and refine it. Then you have to, you know, put it into places where you can make coins out of it. You have to pay for a stamp to be able to stamp, you know, imprint the coins. And then you have to, you know, issue it out into society. So there's far more of a real world cost, a real world sowing and reaping than there is with fiat currency. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, and on top of that, fiat currency enables governments and central banks, because they can create value out of thin air, it functionally allows them to be gods. And so, you know, where do you get that idea from? Well, when in the beginning, how does God create the world? He says, let there be light. He speaks things into existence. He says, let there be, and then they are. And so this word, the word let there be in Latin is the word fiat. Mm-hmm. So fiat lux means let there be light. And so in the case of fiat currency, it's governments trying to, again, just by literally speaking it into existence, we're going to just decide. We're going to unilaterally decide. We're going to create trillions of dollars and we're going to airdrop it to everyone during COVID. Mm-hmm. You know, all of that money was created out of thin air. It was issued, basically it was put on the national debt tab. And crazily, 40% of all the US dollars that have ever existed were created in like the first year of that COVID response. And so again, fiat currency allows governments to act as though they are deities who can create value out of thin air in ways that Christians would acknowledge this is something only God can do. Only God can create out of thin air. You know, we can use tools that submit themselves to, you know, other realities that God has built into the world, but we can't create value out of thin air. And this is, again, one of the fundamental lies of fiat currency. So in summary, in terms of the way that it affects God, in terms of the way in which it doesn't acknowledge and dishonors God, it's by setting aside the way that God has designed the world to work and saying, we're going to establish our own way. And then again, part of the reason for it, the stated justification for it is, well, we need to have this to be able to protect in a time of crisis. And we need to have these reserves, these extra reserves. We need to be able to, you know, respond accordingly if there's a crisis. And what this strikes me as is this is worry, this is fear, where it says, hey, we need to protect ourselves from the way that God has designed the world to work. And mm-hmm. and that's been a temptation for humanity forever. mm-hmm. I'm going to go outside of God's ordained means of getting things in order to protect myself from the future. So this is one motivation for theft. I'm going to steal because I don't have what I need or I don't have what I want. And so I'm going to take it from somebody else. This is a justification for all kinds of sin is basically I don't have what I want. I don't have what I need. I'm going to go my own way to get it. Mm-hmm. You could go a long ways. So now that's how it affects God. That's why Christians should care. On the other hand, you know, how does this affect my neighbor? What does this have to do with loving my neighbor as myself? Well, again, They may say, oh, we're just creating, governments can say, we're creating this money out of thin air. They're creating it out of thin air. And then what is the purpose of that? They're using it. It enables wealthy people to use that money to buy assets that aren't able to be created out of thin air quickly, the way that the money itself is. And so what this has enabled, and what you're seeing, is that fiat currency always enables a large scale wealth transfer from basically the poor to the rich. And so this is another reason why, now again, even this framing, you're like, oh no, this sounds like AOC. This sounds like the left, you know, this. And so one of my favorite things about Bitcoin is it basically takes concerns from either side of the political spectrum, and it paints this, it basically demonstrates to you, hey, there is a grain of truth in the gripes that are being put out there by left, you know, by people who are on the political left. There's grains of truth. That what it doesn't mean is that the way that they're trying to go about them is a productive or good way to do it. But it acknowledges that they're pointing at something real that's actually really causing a pain point for people. So basically, you know, fiat currency, again, think about how this happens. Fiat currency comes into existence through the issuance primarily today of new debt. So people, when, you know, it used to be that if you were going to buy a house, or you're going to buy some sort of, a car or whatever it was, you would go to the bank, and the bank would have deposits, reserves from all the customers of the bank. And the bank would lend out a percentage of the reserves in the bank. They would lend it out and say, all right, this is real money. And so in order to lend this out, you're going to have to pay a certain level of interest, a certain cost of capital, a certain cost for the privilege of getting access to this money that you haven't worked to produce. And so this is the way that it would work. And this is, again, even though we think about something like, you know, 15 or 17% interest rates, we're like, man, that's so high. But again, this is scarce resources. This is, you know, you're getting access. The people are taking a risk to loan you money, for, you know, money that you haven't worked for. They're loaning it to you and entrusting that you're going to make good on this loan that you're taking.
It's the real cost of capital, right? Correct. Like it's the free market determining a cost of capital because there's real work.
Exactly. There's real scarce work. There's real scarce resources involved. Today, the way that happens in a fiat market economy, what happens is that basically you go down to the bank and they will check your credit worthiness. So they'll check how much money you're making right now, what assets you have to potentially provide as collateral. If you don't have assets, if you don't have assets, then it's just your salary. And so then they will set, all right, we're going to give you this interest rate, but it has nothing to do with reserves that are held in the bank. Like all there are zero reserve requirements today. Mm-hmm. Most people do not understand that, do not know this, but it had gotten really low. I think it had gotten down to like 10% reserves. And then when COVID hit, to try to keep this house of cards that's doomed to fail anyhow, from failing in that moment, they said, we're going to remove any reserve requirements from banks. So banks don't have to hold any reserves on hand in order to issue loans. It's completely based on a promise to pay back X amount of money into the future. And so what that does is allows people who don't have, you know, allows people to take on debt and then to go buy scarce resources. That means that there are that much less scarce resources for everybody else in society to be able to purchase. And so it drives up artificially the cost of these goods. There's effectively an unlimited amount of money that's competing to buy in a scarce amount of houses, cars, whatever it is. And so this has a disastrous effect on normal people's ability to, you know, over time to accumulate resources and to buy things like a house, to buy things like a car. You're looking at astronomically increasing prices of these scarce goods as fiat, you know, as the fiat Ponzi starts to unwind. And so it has this, you know, very impactful, very, calamitous effects on families, on specifically nonprofit organizations, and then over time on everybody. Again, this is something that really impacted me because, you know, I was working for a nonprofit organization. I was working for a missionary organization, and missionary organizations depend on donations. They depend on, you know, people giving, you know, in being generous and giving to these things because they're saying there's work that's so important. The most important work is unpaid with money. The most important work in the world is not money that's done for profit. Parenting, all of these things. Parenting is the most valuable thing in the world. If you don't, I mean, just to try to recreate the value of what parents do through sheer economic forces would be insane. I mean, just the amount of time you're with, 24-hour care, you know, like all these things, it's just way too much. And so when you have a nonprofit organization that's dependent on donations, as inflation continues to rise, you have monetary inflation, there's more and more money competing for more or less the same amount of goods. If you are a for-profit business, you can raise your prices to account for those changes. You know, as your cost of production goes up, you can raise the prices and basically pass that cost increase along to your customers. But if you're a nonprofit organization, if you're a church, if you're a charity or whatever it is, you know, you don't have a product that you can increase the price of. You have to go find new money or more money from the same people in order to continue doing the same thing that you were doing before. Mm-hmm. And so over time, this has it just tears down and eats away, death by a thousand cuts, at you know, just the vast majority of people who are operating within a culture. So again, there's the two things. It affects God in very real ways, made up things. It basically is ignoring the way that God designed the world to function and setting him aside and installing our own way that we want the world to work in its stead. And then on the other hand, it just has this breaking away at the fabric of society, breaking away at the margin for individuals, families, businesses, and nonprofit organizations to be able to operate. And it basically ever increases the size of government. This is another effect, is that governments get bigger and bigger and bigger. And that has an exponentially, deleterious impact on everything as well.
Hey, just a quick break and we'll get back to the show, but I want to introduce you to our very first sponsor of the Bitcoin Way podcast, Satoshi Coffee Company. Satoshi Coffee, sats.coffee is the URL. They make high quality, fresh roasted coffee, and they even put the block number to show proof of work on each bag. If you're watching on YouTube, you can see that. I'm not a coffee snob, but I'm sort of picky about what I do enjoy. And this Satoshi blend, which is one of their more popular blends, is incredible. They also have a blend from El Salvador and a couple of others. I'd highly recommend you trying out all of them. But the cool thing about Satoshi Coffee Company is they are Bitcoin only and only accept Bitcoin as payment. And as a Bitcoin Way podcast listener, you get 6.9% off if you go to sats.coffee and enter code TBW69. Again, Satoshi Coffee Company, sats.coffee. Check them out. Support Bitcoin only companies like Satoshi Coffee Company.
So I have a sister who's a Bible teacher and like multiple graduate degrees. Okay. So I run everything by her, like any of these questions. I'd be curious to hear. And she owns a little bit of Bitcoin because I've badgered her into it, but she's not like a Bitcoiner. I need to get her your book and have her spend some time with it. But so I'm curious. One of the things I asked her about, this is sort of just a one-off random question, but when you think about tithing, so like right now I'm paid in Bitcoin. Okay. And my church doesn't accept Bitcoin.
Yep.
And so I've sort of posed this to her in a few ways. Like, I don't think I could probably orange pill church leadership, and I don't have the relationship with church leadership to do that anyway.
Yeah.
And so I've posed this as like a hypothetical. Should I be converting Bitcoin to fiat to tithe, from income, or should I try to figure out how to orange pill the church and have them keep some of their treasury in Bitcoin? Or should I just set aside a certain amount of Bitcoin, so that way when they inevitably are forced onto a Bitcoin standard, I've got this sort of reserve that I can say, hey, I've got something to provide you. How would you think about something like that?
I would think about this the same way I would think about as a parent. Should I teach my kid, should I teach him the Bible? Should I teach him philosophy? Should I teach him history? I'd be like, yes. Yes, you should. And so I think it's the same thing. So I think you should. I mean, I would. Yeah, I think this is, and I think you're convinced as well. Like, I think that this is a big enough issue at this point where I would just tithe in the Bitcoin. I would basically be setting aside the Bitcoin, letting your pastor know, like, hey, I am tithing. I just want you to know I'm tithing. I'm not just, withholding this, but I think this is a big deal. And so I'm going to put this in Bitcoin. I think setting it aside and then going to them at some point and having this conversation, starting the conversation. And then again, over time, you know, putting them in a place where, you know, hey, I want to show you this. I don't know. You could give them like a watch only wallet. Hey, I want to have the accountability here. I've tied this much Bitcoin. And I want you to be able to see that it's there. Okay. Mm-hmm. So here, I'm going to give you the ability to have a watch only wallet where you can see, hey, this money is here. And maybe again, once every couple months or something, you're going to go to him and say, hey, I just want you to know this is here. I'm giving, because again, I think that again, it's just like anything, like people are going to, they're going to wish that they had done the work down the road when they realize, mm-hmm. oh no, this is really is worse. So that would be what I would do if I was you. I would just leave it in Bitcoin. I wouldn't, because again, then you're gonna incur a penalty in order to transfer it from you know, or like the whatever the taxes in order to change it from Bitcoin to fiat. So I would do that if I was you.
I think that makes sense. That was sort of my stance, and my sister felt like that because I think she doesn't have the conviction in Bitcoin. It's like, okay, yeah. But what if Bitcoin doesn't work? You know, like to us, it feels. Yep. Closer to inevitable than it does for her, where she's like, I get sort of hypothetically, but also make sure that you're being generous and not, you know, withholding, 100%. Which I completely get.
The other thing I would say with that is just, again, you're talking about a risk reward proposition here, mm-hmm. right? Like if, let's say in the worst case, you know, Bitcoin, you know, either Bitcoin breaks down in 5 years, you know, it just disappears, goes to zero. Or Bitcoin, or you know, the every government official becomes a Christian tomorrow, and they all recognize we're sinning against God by trying to be gods, and they're mm-hmm. like, all right, we need to go back to scarce currency. Let's say that happens tomorrow. Okay, all of those things happen. Again, you're one person at your church. Okay, I don't know how big your church is, but you're still talking like a small percentage, very likely, of the total income for the church. Mm-hmm. You can think about, like, I would think about you, like, I would think about you, I do think about this, like, think about it as like an insurance policy. Like, I think of, like, even if you're one member out of a couple hundred and, you know, you're the insurance policy, if Bitcoin does what it's been doing, you're going to be able to out carry your weight exponentially relative to other people. If it doesn't, mm-hmm. then you're still just one person who's giving, you know, to your church. Right. So,
yeah. Again, cause I think a lot of this comes back to like, it's a matter of the heart, right? Like if there was some reason I was deferring or then I think we get into a whole different issue, but I think. Yeah. Like I guess my perspective is someone who has taken the time to go down the rabbit hole and understand this and to look back through history and see what Bitcoin has done and anticipate where it's going. It feels more prudent and thoughtful to like be this safety mechanism for the church that, to your point, as a nonprofit, is probably being disproportionately affected. Correct. By the troubles of fiat. So,
yeah. And again, that's another thing we didn't even talk about is just the witness of history. Like, mm-hmm. again, this is, I mean, Paul, the Apostle Paul talks about, he's like, follow the traditions that you have in me. So there's mm-hmm. obviously like, there's you that you've received from me. So there's scripture, right? Like there is scriptures. I mean, obviously final, like if scripture says something, that's the final thing. But in areas where scripture doesn't directly talk to it, then in some of those we have tradition. And so we have historically informed, you know, we want to learn from history. We want to mm-hmm. learn from the errors of history. And so Bitcoin, people who get into Bitcoin and do the work to understand it, recognize, wait, this is something that has literally happened hundreds of times throughout history. This is not something new we're predicting is going to happen for the first time. You know, this is something like fiat currencies fail. Every single fiat currency fails. Mm-hmm. And so I think that this is, again, you're taking seriously, you know, just the witness of history. And so I think that would be another thing that, again, can earn credibility. It's still, again, you still could have pastors who think it's the weirdest thing ever. But again, you're saying, hey, I want to give to the church. I want to be generous. I think that this is the most prudent for the church. And so,
I'm going to give in this. So here's another, this is, sort of unrelated to Bitcoin as a mechanism for serving the world. But I'll give you a quick anecdote. So my following on Twitter X is really small right now, but a week or so ago, I saw someone share something. It was effectively a meme that was sort of mocking Bitcoiners who say that Bitcoin culture is a problem for adoption. Mm-hmm. And I commented on it and said, hey, let me just give you two anecdotes. I've talked to people who have said, like one in financial services, for example, part of the reason, like a lot of financial service providers, advisors, those sorts of people aren't into Bitcoin is because of Bitcoiners. Like the culture and the way that we, you know, and in many instances, just sort of look down on people who don't get it. I'm not anti toxic Bitcoin maximalism, depending on how you define that, right? Like, I think there's a time and a place to push people who are, what's the way of saying this? But like the Peter Schiffs of the world, right? Like the people who are just like, they haven't gotten it. And it's just, they're talking people out of something that we believe to be a very useful technology. Mm-hmm. I don't think you need to be a jerk to Peter Schiff, but I think fighting him, pushing him hard makes a ton of sense. But I basically expressed that, hey, maybe like some of this cultural, you know, toxicity is a detriment to Bitcoin adoption. Cause I can just tell you from experience, I know a couple of people who are like, I want nothing to do with Bitcoiners. Like, they just seem like jerks to me. That's not my opinion because I have met enough Bitcoiners in real life, but I understand that sentiment looking online. Right. And so after I commented this, the person blocked me. I just made an observation. I got blocked. It was my first time being blocked. And then I had about 10% of my relatively small following. I suddenly lose a bunch of followers. Mm. And so it's like, whatever. Like, I think what I said was right. And I think that's, you know, I think I made a fair point. It was really just an observation, not even like an argument. But what is your opinion on how we approach this topic? Because I think a lot about, if I'm a jerk as a Christian, why would someone want to learn about Christianity, right? I think that's sort of an obvious point. If I'm a jerk and I'm always talking about Bitcoin, am I pushing people away? And to me, it's like, I think the obvious answer is yes, to some degree. To what degree does that matter is a different question. How do you think about this topic?
Yeah. So yeah, if you're talking about Bitcoin at a funeral, okay, you this might not be the time for it. You know, I definitely think, again, there's a lot of parallels. I'm writing a book. I just finished the last chapter on a book called that me and this other guy are writing called The Gospel According to Bitcoin. So basically, the book does the exact opposite of what Bitcoin does. Thank God for Bitcoin does. Thank God for Bitcoin is written to explain Bitcoin and that really even more than Bitcoin. We only spend two chapters on Bitcoin, but just the ideas and theology undergirding really Austrian economics and sound, the ideas of sound money. It was designed to explain that to Christians. This book is designed to explain the gospel to Bitcoiners. Like, this is a book that's written, like, we just talk about a lot of things. We look at Bitcoin, we treat Bitcoin as a parable through which you can understand all kinds of, just principles with, you know, from the gospel itself or faith more broadly, like all kinds of stuff. And so I think one of the ways in which there's carryover or similarities, you know, is like the Apostle Paul talks about, like, basically being with, you know, presenting the gospel with gentleness in all respect. Like, he basically saying, like, your character matters in terms of presenting the gospel. Like, your character can either lend to the message and add to the credibility of the gospel, or it can detract from it. And so I think that that's absolutely a real thing. Telling new people who have genuine questions, you know, to have fun staying poor, like does not honor God, number one. And then number two is not going to be effective. Like, that's not going to be effective. Now here's where this, you know, there's more, it's not always as straightforward, is because Jesus, for example, calls the Pharisees hypocrites like 100 times. No, it's more like 12 times or something. He calls them serpents. He calls them sons of hell. He calls them sons of your father, the devil. Paul calls, the Pharisees, he calls the Jews, he calls them the synagogue of Satan. The Apostle Paul says that he would rather, so the Pharisees were saying, you're more spiritual if you're circumcised. And so Paul's, you know, basically, if you cut off this small piece of skin, okay, then you're more spiritual. God loves you more. And so the Apostle Paul, I think it's in Galatians, it's this fantastic thing. He says, I wish that those who would unsettle you, who are trying to unsettle you, would emasculate themselves. And so he basically is saying, like, the Pharisees are saying, you're more spiritual if you cut off a small piece of skin from your member. I wish that those guys would cut off their entire member and be even more spiritual. You know, they'll be super spiritual to do that. So I do think there's a place to speak, you know, very frankly. I do think there's a place for mocking. I do think that, and Peter Schiff is honestly one of these examples where, like, Peter Schiff has willfully ignored Bitcoin for forever. Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. He's too intelligent of a man to really believe the things that he's saying right now about it being, like, I just don't buy it. But
yeah, he's misled a lot of people.
Correct.
And there are a lot of people who I think have remained skeptical of Bitcoin that wouldn't. And I think that's where I get defensive. Like, some of my favorite people, like Tony, who works at the Bitcoin Way. I mean, he's one of these, you know, really assertive, toxic style. You know, and I love him. I love listening to him. Saifedean, like, right? I mean, these are just some awesome people. I mean, Jimmy. So it's not like this blanket statement that, like, toxic Bitcoin maximum is bad. I think it depends on the context, but there are so many things that are said that, to me, I'm like, I try to put myself in the position of, like, someone who isn't there yet.
Yeah.
And what does that look like? And how inclined are you toward this incredibly powerful movement?
Yeah.
If most of what you see is just like this loud, have fun staying poor,
yeah,
sort of mindset.
I'll give you another example. It's a great point. And again, so much of this, like, so much of what we're describing is wisdom. It requires wisdom. Mm-hmm. And then I'll give you an example. So in the book of Proverbs, Proverbs 26, I think it's 3 and 4 or 4 and 5, or it could be 5 and 6. It's the verse where it says, do not answer a fool according to his folly. Okay. And then it gives, like, a reason why, and you're like, okay, so if I encounter a fool, the godly way to respond is to not answer him, you know, not to answer him the same way. You're like, great, check. The very next verse says, answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own eyes. So in two consecutive verses in the Bible, you have them saying the complete opposite of how to respond to a fool.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what are you supposed to do in that situation? You're supposed to, so if you encounter a fool, which one do you do? Well, it requires wisdom. There's some of those fools who you need to have the wisdom to figure out, all right, these are a fool. This is a fool to answer. There's other fools where you need to go, yeah, it's just not, like, it's not going to be profitable to respond. Now, how do you know which one? Okay. It requires wisdom.
Yeah. You
know, like, it depends on the situation. What are the situations? And so I think this is, there's a similarity here with, you know, with similar. So again, we need to think about toxic, mocking is this great tool when it's employed in the right time and towards the right people and towards the right end. So again, there's times when Jimmy and Saifedean are coming out and they're mocking and ridiculing and basically, like, shining light on the false, disingenuous ways that some of these altcoin projects are presenting themselves. They're demonstrated lies, demonstrated things that they're saying, and they're going to town and destroying them. Fire the laser. Like, let's go. Fantastic. There's other situations, though, in which, you know, somebody has a question, or again, you know, there's other times in which, you know, you can't. Yeah, there's times to use a there's times to use a pistol, and there's times to use a bomb. Mm-hmm. And the danger is that you use a bomb when you should just use a pistol, or, you know, or vice versa. And so I think that's kind of the thing. And again, especially from people who aren't Christians, like, Saifedean is not a Christian. So I don't hold him, you know, to the same standard as I would hold, you know, other people too. So I think that's, it is one of these things where, again, just recognizing the damage that's being done, like, we ought to, I mean, Jesus was very harsh with people. Why was he harsh with the Pharisees? Why was Paul harsh with the Pharisees? Because of the ramifications
correct. Of what they were doing. Yeah,
realization of the ramifications of what they're doing. And so I think there's a place for that.
Maybe that's kind of a way of thinking of it. It is you know, when you're just bickering with someone online and you're turning off a potential future Bitcoiner because whose doubts or skepticism have no ramifications to the Bitcoin project, then maybe it's wise to let it go and to try engaging with them in a thoughtful, kind way. Yep. And when it's Peter Schiff, who actually has an audience and is turning people away from something that fixes so many problems, that's the time to engage. And I think, and I think that's kind of like, you know, talk about Jimmy, like he's one of the best, I think, at really identifying the flaws in these alternative, they're not alternatives to Bitcoin, but these other projects, right, that are sometimes conflated with Bitcoin. It's like those are to the detriment of this Bitcoin renaissance that's before us, because it distracts and it confuses. And I totally see it. I think it's completely justified. I think we just need to be more discerning, I guess, is my whole point.
Yeah. Here's another thing too. I think that there's a place for being theatrical in some of these things too. So again, I think about, you go to the, if you're using the scriptures, so the prophet Isaiah walked around naked for 3 years. Mm-hmm. To protest like some of the things that were going on in Israel. God told them to walk around naked for 3 years. Can you fathom if some pastor came out and said, "Hey, got a word from the Lord. I'm supposed to walk around naked for 3 years." He'd be excommunicated from his church. He'd be put in a mental asylum, like the whole thing. It would be crazy. There's another place in, where is it? It's not Micah. It's one of the minor prophets. And he's basically talking, and he's talking about these women. Women who they lay around on their couches all day and they tell their husbands to come bring them drinks. And he calls them, he's like, "Oh, you cows of Bashan." So he calls these women cows, and you're just like, can you fathom if a pastor did this today? And yet this is the inspired word of God to do this. So I think there's a place for spectacle in calling attention to injustice. Mm-hmm. And so again, this is reserved for the people who are partaking in injustice. So here's an example. I think that there's some people, some financial advisors who up until recently wouldn't have considered Bitcoin because they have big companies telling them what products to sell. Mm-hmm. So they have a conflicted interest in terms of being even willing to consider the value of Bitcoin. Because, I could lose my job, or, we don't have a product for this. We don't have a way for us to make money off. You know, BlackRock doesn't have a way until recently for me to make money off, for them to make money off of this. And so I'm not allowed to say anything. I think those people are people who, again, you could justify, all right, like you're not actually out here looking for truth necessarily. Like you're here, you're looking at this through a jaded lens. And so I think there's a potential for some of those people maybe to under certain circumstances to be called out in some of the ways that we see people being called out. But again, it should not be your default tool. Mm-hmm. It should not be your go-to thing anytime somebody talks to you or anytime you talk to somebody about Bitcoin. And I think that something that helps that would be also just remembering this, like what the stakes. Now, again, for me, this has been particularly easy in talking to people, especially in like, I have more, at least somewhat, I earn somewhat more sympathy with people in talking to them because I bring up the Venezuelan refugees. It's kind of hard just to toss aside the Venezuelan refugees. You know, I can say, hey, again, you might not think Bitcoin is very valuable, but you know, I have brothers and sisters in Jesus who, you know, had to walk across the border from Venezuela into Colombia. If they had gold or silver, or if, you know, their fiat currency had been reduced to worthlessness, if they had gold or silver, it's going to be stolen from them as they're walking across the border with it. You know, Bitcoin enables them to have something that they can memorize a passphrase in their head across any border in the world. Nobody even knows they have it. You know, that's very valuable to them. You might not value that, but it's very valuable to them given their circumstances. Mm-hmm. And so I think that helping people to see, oh wait, my experience is not everyone's experience. I love trying to subvert the usage of this phrase, but there's lots of privilege talk these days. And this is one of the things I'm like, hey, like Americans, you have a very privileged view. You've had the exorbitant privilege of having the world reserve currency for a couple generations now. Many people around the world do not have that. and the consequences are very dire. And so it drives them to look for alternatives, including Bitcoin. I think, again, using something like that, it can be just as powerful. It can be just as, you know, hitting them between the eyes to help them realize, wait, I don't see this the way that I, you know, I don't see all of the factors here. There's much more going on here than maybe I've been aware of. And so that's kind of the goal that you're looking for. You want to help people to see there's something here that you don't see. I go back and forth. I see them as they're both good tools. There's different ways to go about this. I mean, I think the popularity of something like John Oliver's Last Week Tonight show, it's crude, crass. There's tons of stuff that I wouldn't say, you know, that he does, but there's a reason why it's one of the most popular shows. They've won the Emmy, I think like 4 or 5 years in a row. Mm-hmm. It's because where there is injustice, they shine a light on it. Now, obviously they have different definitions of injustice. They've like ridiculed Christians a zillion times, but there's plenty of things, plenty of the episodes that they do are actually highlighting actual injustice and wickedness that is being perpetrated against normal people, and mocking and scoffing is a very effective tool for helping generate awareness and for getting people to care about something that maybe they just don't care about. I think there's reasons to use that tool and reasons and time to set it aside. But I certainly wouldn't just get rid of the toxicness. I think it's necessary.
Yeah. So I guess to recap, before all you listeners cancel me or Jordan for that matter, I think we agree. There's a time, yes, and a place for this, correct, sort of so-called toxic maximalism. My encouragement is just, you know, especially in real life, but it's like, here's the thing, is there's a social cost to treating people a particular way in real life that you don't, correct, incur online.
Correct.
And so it's really easy to be brave sitting behind a computer, correct, and you're not really brave, right? Like you're just, you know, yelling into the ether. So I think just being mindful of that, like if you want your uncle or your cousin or your brother to join this party with us, which is I think what most people, because again, every Bitcoiner I meet in real life is awesome.
Yeah.
If you really want them to join the party, I mean, the way to do that is not yelling, it's not have fun staying poor, it's not, you know, any of these tactics. Like that's how we, I think, should be addressing the people who are like a material detriment to this Bitcoin movement.
Correct.
So,
correct. And the other last thing I would say is like, or a couple things. Like one of them would be, again, you also have to recognize that there's people who sound very kind who are actually ravenous wolves.
Yes.
A lot of these other projects, you're like, oh man, this guy sounds very smart. And, you know, he's not toxic. And actually, this guy from this other project he's speaking out about how toxic these Bitcoin guys are. Oh, and you know, they're just so closed-minded. They only see this. And a lot of that can just be couched in, I want to take advantage of people who don't understand the issues at play. And so I think that's part of the challenging thing as well, is like, you need to know there's people who want to take your money, like who want to just prey on people. And one of the ways that they're going to try to get you to do that is by sounding nice and very kind. And so I think that requires some, you know, again, Jesus tells us to be wise as serpents and innocent as doves. He warns us that we're going to need to have wisdom, and we can't just trust, you know, even people's tone. They might seem nice on the surface, but they can still be awful. The last thing I would say is, I would say again, the best thing, the best possible way that you can have for introducing someone who, you know, isn't into Bitcoin, is get them in a situation where they have to think about it for more than just 5 minutes. And so events like, again, shill our own event, we have the Thank God for Bitcoin conference. It's going to be in Nashville on July 24th and 25th. We're going to have 500 people who are there. And for 2 days, we're going to talk about, you know, a lot of these issues. The first day is going to be casting a robust Christian vision for economics. We're going to talk very little about Bitcoin. You know, what are some of the issues at play? What's going on in the world? And then day two, we're going to talk a lot about like, what does Bitcoin have to do with Jerusalem? You know, what does Bitcoin have to do with these things that we've talked about from a scriptural standpoint and that are going on in the world? And so inviting people, and having them come and just kind of think about Bitcoin for, you know, for more than just one conversation can be a really helpful thing. Mm-hmm. Again, people have said that the average person hears the gospel 7 times before they become a Christian. I have no idea about the methodology of how they've determined that. I'm very dubious of that. But if it is true, let's just say it takes more than a couple times to interact with Jesus in order to find it compelling, or to basically hear enough where you have enough of an understanding where you're gonna become a Christian. And so I think there's something very similar with Bitcoin. It's a complex thing. There's so many aspects of it that that are difficult to understand, that we don't talk about in society. And so you need more time to sit with it many times in order to kind of get a grasp of it. And so events like ours, or other Bitcoin events, are can be really helpful and more fruitful than just one-off conversation somewhere.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. Well, so hey, let's sort of round this out here. So thank God for Bitcoin. As you mentioned, it's taken on a life of its own. I mean, you've got the conference. It's a catchphrase in the community. You've got the book. Could you I guess what I'm just curious is what's I understand that the mission is let's onboard Christians into Bitcoin. I mean, I think that's a lot of what you all do. Is there anything else that you would talk about with Thank God for Bitcoin that you're after, any sort of support or anything new that's coming up that we should be keeping an eye out on?
I mean, honestly, again, my goal from the beginning, and my goal with even doing this, so again, the Cliff Notes version is I came back from the mission field. We basically had transitioned out of the church that we were at. The church, we had merged with another small church, and they had leadership that was going to be there for the long term. And we hadn't taken a furlough the entire time we'd been on the mission field. So came back, and then we're trying to figure out what we're going to do next, and had some of the Jimmy and some of the other guys. We did a one-day conference. And then in the aftermath of that, Jimmy just basically said, Jimmy and some of the other guys said, if you want to do this as a full-time thing, we're willing to fund it and help you do it. And so again, my thinking going in was the people who are doing the most valuable work in the world, like in terms of making disciples, they're working in hundreds of countries around the world. And those people are able to do less and less of that work with every day that goes by because money, the fiat currency gets more and more worthless. And so my goal from the beginning has been this race against time to basically have these conversations with ministry leaders, with pastors, denominational leaders, all kinds of stuff. That's been my goal, is just both create resources and facilitate conversations so that, again, even if it's going to take 7 times, we can start the process now. Mm-hmm. Like I want to start these conversations with these organizations to help them be thinking about them. Even if they're thinking the first 3 times, like, this is dumb, I don't see it. At least you're thinking about it. And even more, start to see, because again, Christians are some of the most internationally invested people. They are the most internationally invested people by population. You have people who are praying for the nations. You have people who are giving money to help the gospel go to countries all over the world. The Christians inherently care about the nations. Jesus told us to go into all the world and make disciples. This is literally the last thing he says. He leaves us this mission. And so Christians are invested in that. And so trying to demonstrate, the ways in which fiat currency makes church planting or over the world or missions organizations or just normal nonprofit charity work, it makes all of these things exponentially more difficult and actually renders work that's been done in the past less and less valuable. And so this is a structural thing that's broken, and Bitcoin fixes this in structural ways. That's been our goal, is to kind of have those conversations. In addition to that, we are like, we have to, keep the lights on. And so we're trying to figure out, we're still working at this, is like, ways to monetize. And so the conference is the primary way. If you want to support Thank God for Bitcoin and you can get to our conference in Nashville, like that's a huge way. And if you have people who, if you have the means and you have people in your life who you'd love to come, but you don't think would be, willing to pay to do that, then like subsidizing the cost of, bringing somebody with you or bringing one or two people with you. And then we're working on making that, more feasible as well by, if you have a church and one or two of the pastors come, then we're going to give you a promo code, you know, to give you, you know, even a better discount to get more people from your church to come. Mm-hmm. So again, we're working at those things. We have, again, there's going to be sponsors for the conference as well. So if you, if there's people listening to this who have businesses where, you know, you want to, you feel like it would be a fit to sponsor the conference, that's another way that you can help. Another, I mentioned the book, The Gospel According to Bitcoin. That's going to be, the goal is to have that published and ready at the conference. So you can, we'll have that available on our website store, and you can get that. I also just finished earlier this year the copy for a children's book. It's called The Orange Umbrella. And so that book is now with the illustrator. It's going to be all watercolor illustrations. So
cool.
Yeah, Orange Umbrella basically tells this story, you know, fictional story, obviously, of you know, basically looking at different stores of value or different monies through the eyes of umbrellas, and so, you know, just then there's whole bunch of that. So that's another thing where I think I'm biased because I'm one of the authors of the book, but I think it's going to be a great kids book. There's very few Bitcoin kids books. The whole thing rhymes. It's very Dr. Seussy. And if you're a Christian, there's things that you'll pick up on that, you know, even the average person wouldn't pick up on. So, I'm like very optimistic that's going to be a widely received and a helpful thing. I think it's just going to be, it's a lot of fun. It's going to allow families to spend time together and then, you know, learn about some of these issues as well. So I think those are ways that are coming down the pike that people can benefit from. And then again, if you work for a church, you work for, you know, a missionary organization or other nonprofits, like we're happy to do consulting, you know, happy to hop on a call and answer questions and, you know, point people in the direction of tools and resources. You know, we have like an affiliate code, with some of the Bitcoin exchanges, you know, where people, if they're, you know, looking for help in or just investment advice, you know, we're not qualified investors, but we can point you to people who can help you think through like tax strategies and all kinds of different stuff. So those are some of the different ways that you can find out more information at tgfb.com is our website.
Perfect. Where can people find you online if they want to keep up with you?
Yeah. So the easiest way is Twitter, Twitter. So just if you, I am, at JM, Bush, BUSH, Writes, WRITES, I'm on Twitter and you can find me there. Hit me up with a DM. I'm trying to think. Somebody said that they didn't pay for Twitter. And so they're, like they couldn't DM me, which is weird, but yeah, if you want to just hit me or just like reply to one of my posts or something, I'll see it. And then I'll just DM you that way. But yeah, happy to do anything I can to help anybody trying to, you know, get questions answered.
Perfect. Jordan, hey, thank you so much for your time, man. This has been fun. I mean, for someone who I think shares the faith, these are just interesting topics to explore. Yep. And I think Christian or not, I think just some of the work you're doing is important. I mean, driving Bitcoin adoption in new and unique places that not everyone is engaging with. So thank you for all that you do. And everyone, check him out. Check out Thank God for Bitcoin. Get the book. It's a great book. I need to gift that to my sister because I think she could do some damage sharing it with some people in her community. So
awesome.
Jordan, thank you so much, man. Look forward to connecting sometime soon.
Yep. Sounds good, Michael. Thank you.
Cheers.
And that's a wrap. Again, I appreciate you being here. I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Jordan. I think Jordan's a really cool guy and offers very interesting and unique insight into Bitcoin and how he thinks Bitcoin could be a net positive on a large scale for the entire world. Check out Thank God for Bitcoin. Buy the book. It really is an interesting read. Christian or not, I think it's just one worth having and another perspective worth looking into. But you can also follow him on Twitter and X, as he said. Check out Thank God for Bitcoin, the sort of pre-conference to the big conference that's going to be taking place in Nashville, or maybe actually will have taken place by the time this recording comes out. But anyway, look at what they're doing. If you need help with Bitcoin self-custody, don't forget to look at The Bitcoin Way. We are a white glove premium service helping you take full self-sovereign self-custody of your Bitcoin without any trusted third parties, key sharing, any of that sort of stuff. We don't compromise on what we do and how we help. And personally, don't forget to follow me on Twitter X. It's at the other M Jordan. And my personal Bitcoin newsletter is blackhatbitcoin.substack.com. Until next time, this is Michael Jordan signing off.